Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very excited to share that I recently launched 365 Days with Medieval and Renaissance Wonder Women. This immersive learning experience is much more than just an online course. Over 12 months in 2025, participants will come together and contribute to a supportive and inspiring online community of individuals who'll share in a unique learning experience, one that will ultimately deepen their understanding of the lives and experiences of medieval and Renaissance women. Together, we'll explore the contributions made by a variety of European women and celebrate, among other qualities, their courage, creativity, resourcefulness, and resilience. I will guide participants every step of the way, but I'll also be joined by a stellar list of 28 contributors, including the brilliant broadcaster, best-selling author, and Oxford academic, Dr. Yanina Ramirez, who'll deliver the opening address. Head to my website onthetudortrail.com for further details, including a full list of sessions and presenters, and also testimonials from current participants. I do hope you'll consider joining me on this unique learning experience. I'd also like to take this opportunity to acknowledge and thank the generous listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. As an independent podcaster, this means a lot to me. If you love the podcast and you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors patron family. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. When you join the community, you'll instantly unlock access to exclusive posts. Patrons are also eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and take part in a member-only book club. They can also enter patron-only monthly giveaways, to name but a few of the perks. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. There are a number of designs and products available, including phone cases, mugs, notebooks, and apparel. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm excited to welcome Danielle Burton to the podcast to talk about Anthony Woodville. Danielle is a historian with a focus on the life of Anthony Woodville, but is also a history blogger who focuses on little-known stories from roughly the 15th to the 19th centuries. She's worked and volunteered in the heritage sector since 2016 and has a first in history and an MA in public history and heritage from the University of Derby. Let's dive straight into our conversation. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Danielle. How are you?
All right. How are you, Natalie?
I'm well, thank you. I've been looking forward to our conversation. So let's start by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about you and your background.
Yeah, so I suppose the easiest way to explain is the fact that I've been interested in history, well, forever, really, thanks to, family taking me out to all sorts of historical sites, and that's kind of where that started, really. But I have a BA and an MA from the University of Derby in history, and then an MA in public history and heritage. So I've kind of worked in heritage since 2016, both voluntary and paid roles. And I've basically kind of cemented my love of history in all different facets, really, through that. But so for the last 9 years, I've actually been researching the life of Anthony Woodville, the brother-in-law of Edward IV, which is hopefully what I'm here to talk to you today about.
Yes, absolutely. So this is the subject of your new book, and we are here to talk about him. So what sparked your interest in his life in particular?
So really, I came to know about Anthony Woodville. So I've basically been a member of the Richard III Society since I was 9 years old, through family memberships. And I kind of knew of him through his connections with Richard III and how his life ended being executed on the orders of Richard III. So that's how I knew of him. But I didn't really kind of get involved in learning more about his life until, like I say, about 9 years ago, when I went on a family visit to Pontefract Castle, which is the site that he was executed at. I noticed that there actually wasn't really anything about him and what happened to him there at all. And there's a lot of interpretation at the time. I'm hoping that will change at some point. It's been very much about the fact that it was actually Richard II who died there, which, you know, understandably, he was a king. But I can remember asking some of the people who worked there, you know anything about what it would have been like for Anthony Woodville being here? And they literally had no idea who I was on about. And that's kind of where it all started, because I thought, right, okay, how can you not know about this person who was the brother-in-law of Edward IV?
Wonderful. Yeah, I find that going to places connected to people often get that emotional connection, and it does inspire you to do more research. I know it definitely happened with me after my first visit to the Tower in Hampton Court. So
yeah.
What do we know of his family and his early life?
Yeah, so the easiest place to start is with his parents, Jacquetta and Richard Woodville. So Jacquetta was actually, she was a daughter of Luxembourg, really. So, which has had lots of connections to like the royalist court in France, that sort of thing. So actually she was quite high nobility. And she actually was the wife at first of the John Duke of Bedford, who was the regent to France at that time when on in Henry VI's minority. So you kind of think, okay, how does she then end up marrying Richard Woodville, who is basically nothing more than a knight, you know, a very basic knight in Bedford's household. So we don't actually know exactly when their relationship started, but that's how they became connected anyway, was through Bedford's household. Because when she was widowed, when Bedford died, because there was quite a large age gap between them, she was still a fairly young, eligible woman, really, because obviously, why wouldn't you want to marry her, really? But actually, it's basically a love story, a match that would have never been made otherwise. And they basically fell in love and married. And because of that, Richard Woodville actually ended up having to be given titles to kind of make up the quite large social difference. Actually, you don't really start to notice evidence of gossip about their match, actually, until you get their daughter Elizabeth Woodville marrying Edward IV. First instance that we do know that Anthony kind of props up himself in the sources is actually when him and his father, and there's arguments as to whether Jacquetta was taken as well, they were captured by the Yorkists in Sandwich, because they were actually Lancastrian to start off with, even though obviously after Elizabeth married Edward IV, they had to stay Yorkist, and they did. So they actually started off Lancastrian, obviously, you know, with them having their connections to Bedford, that makes sense at that point. But they're actually captured in Sandwich in Kent and taken to Calais and kind of paraded as this booty in front of Edward, the Earl of March, before he becomes Edward IV and Earl of Warwick. And that's kind of the only instance that we have that there's a lot of backlash as to this massive social gap between the couple. And that's kind of the first instance that we have of Anthony kind of appearing in sources himself, is basically this parade in front of the Yorkist hierarchy.
So let's fast forward to Elizabeth Woodville being on the throne now. So in what capacity does Anthony serve his sister?
Yeah, so actually, I think the thing that we get is that by that point, by their marriage, Edward and Elizabeth's marriage, that you kind of have the idea of the Woodvilles, because they are quite a large family, that they are taking up the marriage market. But actually, Anthony was probably married in the run-up to Taunton, so that's before, you know, a few years before Edward's and Elizabeth's marriage. So actually, he's not only has been given titles and roles that he's meant to play in this Yorkist household, now that he's actually, you know, his sister's married into that regime. So, for example, he ends up being like a diplomat as well. So he ends up, him and Richard Woodville end up being diplomats, helping to negotiate Margaret of York, the youngest sister of Edward IV's marriage to Charles, the future Duke of Burgundy. So it's kind of things like that as well. But actually, in terms of, you know, what role specifically with Elizabeth Woodville. He actually is still, he's still, you know, his sister's favourite sibling. So there's still that bit going off. But actually, his wife, Elizabeth Scales, so I said, explained that he probably married before the Battle of Towton in the run-up to that in around about 1460, 1461. She actually ends up being a lady-in-waiting to Queen Elizabeth. So there's that connection there as well. Which is quite interesting because Elizabeth Scales herself is actually, you can't find much about her personally. So I think it's quite telling that what you do see is usually within the context of this role of Elizabeth Woodville's lady-in-waiting. So obviously Anthony plays a role in that, but he's obviously part of this you know, circle that is built, being built up around both Elizabeth and Edward after their marriage. But also he's playing more important roles with diplomacy, military aspects, you know, things like that at this point.
Yeah, it sounds like he was quite talented in his own right, not just because of his sister's elevation, which is what people always assume, don't they, straight away?
Yeah.
Anthony goes on to succeed his father as Earl Rivers in 1469. So what military campaigns does he become involved in after this particular elevation?
Well, actually, the other interesting thing is that, you know, we see the Wars of the Roses very often as very much a solely military experience, really, without forgetting that there are other aspects. But actually, Anthony himself doesn't necessarily take part in a lot of the military campaigns, which is also probably why he's not necessarily well known, because a lot of the other nobles pretty much took part in pretty much all of the battles that we can imagine with this time period. So actually, his first one that he's involved in, that, you know, after they become the Yorkists, is actually straight away is when they are helping to defend Northumberland against Lancastrians and Scots, their Scots counterparts as well. So actually, he first becomes involved in that, and most notably in the Siege of Alnwick Castle, which is the last of the Northumberland castles to kind of, you know, be defended. So he kind of has little bits before then. For example, after his elevation, it's mostly you kind of see him, he's not actually really at like the big ones, like he's not at Tewkesbury, because actually he's at that point he's actually in charge of the Tower of London. So he was actually in London defending London from other Lancastrian rebels that were kind of hoping that they could take the capital whilst everybody else was off fighting in Tewkesbury. So that's probably his most famous one. The whole of that episode of defending London is about the fact that there's these forces led by the Bastard of Falkenberg, one of the Lancastrian high rebels. So he's brought a load of ships and come over on, you know, through the Thames that way. And actually at that point, the citizens of London are actually having to defend their homes and, you know, all that sorted. So there's quite a lot of chaos going on. But Anthony actually pretty much rides out with his party from the Tower of London to join forces with, you know, the ordinary men and women defending themselves, so that he's actually quite honoured for that. So there's a very famous poem that writes about this whole episode and how much, you know, people were scared that London was going to fall to these rebels, and that Anthony's pretty much the knight in shining armour on a white horse coming out of the Tower of London, and he's, you know, he's alongside ordinary people going, come on, let's do this. That's probably his most famous one that he does, but he does also take part in the Battle of Barnet, and he actually is injured alongside Richard Duke of Gloucester as well, the future Richard III. So they're the main ones that he does militarily, but he's actually also asked to help when England are kind of joining forces in Brittany to kind of defend Brittany from France. So he is involved in little things like that, but not necessarily the big main battles that you think of, really.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's just a matter of his sister wanting to keep him close and safe, or do you think he was not experienced enough for those sorts of big battles? Did you come across any sort of evidence to do with that?
I think it's very much more the fact that actually he's got a lot of other things on his plate, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So after the heir is born, Prince Edward, it's actually Anthony's job to look after him. So he's the one who's placed in charge of, becomes what is known as the governor of the Prince of Wales, which obviously means that he's meant to be the one person in charge of the heir. So I suppose he's probably got some bigger things that means he's got, you know, he has got to be safe in that respect, obviously, because he's the person in charge of the all-important heir for the Yorkist regime. So I think that probably plays quite a large part in it, because it's not that he wasn't capable, because he had, like I said, he did have success in what he did do. It's just that perhaps that he had a lot more important things that meant that he had to be elsewhere.
And so you were talking there about armor and knights in shining armor. So Antony obviously also took part in jousts and the other parts of court life. So tell us a little bit about his jousting career.
Yes, yeah, so actually the Woodvilles were quite a jousting family. So we know we have evidence of Richard Woodville actually fighting against a Spanish knight, you know, when he was younger. So it all kind of, it's a bit of a family connection, really. And we know that Antony's brothers, John and Edward, also competed in tournaments as well. But I suppose as much as they were all champions in their own right, Antony's probably the most well-known. His most famous one that he participated in was the Smithfield Tournament. We imagine that, you know, these jousting tournaments are literally just to show off your military prowess, but the Smithfield tournament was actually part of a diplomatic process as well. So he fought it against Antoine the Bastard of Burgundy. Very funny how pretty much, you know, he ends up fighting this tournament with somebody else called Antony, which I always find that does get a bit confusing if you don't class him as Antoine. So that's all part and parcel of the whole relationship that's been built up with Burgundy after and around Margaret of York's marriage to Charles the Bald, future Duke of Burgundy. So it's all kind of to do with that, because Antoine was actually the bastard brother of Charles. So he was the bastard son of the Duke of Burgundy. So it was kind of seen as they were probably social equals at this point. So it was actually 2 years in the making. So when they had the invites, because obviously it was kind of put up in all of this chivalric ritual, really, though. So when Antony himself was asked to participate, it was kind of, oh, you are doing this, you know, as the king's brother, you know, brother-in-law. That's why you've been chosen. But actually, what I find quite fascinating is that when he was asked, he was down on bended knee in front of his sister and all of her ladies, with his cap open, you know, off his head, and they placed the invite into his hat. So it's all very, very much, you know, chivalry based, really. But when the invite was sent across channel to Antoine, he kind of went, yeah, okay, but I'm off fighting near the moment, so can we leave this until I get back? And it was 2 years later, which is why it was quite so long in the making, really. So basically, it was kind of a case of a way of showing both sides military prowess, but in a way that doing it on a friendly basis, but it didn't really end up that friendly, sadly, which is probably why people, if they have heard of it, you know why you've heard of it, really. So what happened was, it ended up being 2 days, but it should have been a longer tournament. Actually, in the jousting section of it, the Bastard of Burgundy accused Antony of cheating, which, as you can imagine, that was not a nice thing to happen, especially in this age when men's honour meant pretty much everything. Made tempers flare quite a bit, but from what I've noticed, I don't think he did, really. From the kind of personality that he had, it was quite a literally the postcard knight, basically. So I don't think he did. And actually, the Bastard of Burgundy had actually been the victim of a real cheating offence by a German knight previously, so I think he had a bit of a complex about cheating after that. So they had to kind of say, all right, we'd better stop now and continue the next day, because it wasn't just about jousting as we kind of have in our heads. You'd have done other things. So the second day it was actually fighting with swords and axes, that sort of thing. And actually Edward the Fourth's heralds had to intervene, because they pretty much knocked the crap out of each other, basically, which was not the idea of this tournament. Sadly, it ended up being cut short after that, regardless of that, because the Duke of Burgundy actually had died and news had reached England at that point. So that's the most famous one of his military tournaments. But actually, both Antony and Antoine, after that, had agreed that they would never personally fight each other again, to make sure that it was never repeat. On Margaret's marriage to Charles the Bald, they also had a very similar English and Burgundian tournament. And yes, neither of them fought each other. They fought other people. So at least they kept to it after that.
So Antony had other interests. Can you tell us a little bit about his literary interests and his connection to the printer, William Caxton, as well?
Yeah, so personally, I think this is what makes Antony a lot more of an important part of this part of the 15th century than perhaps has been realised before. We know that he probably did have some form of library himself, but obviously we're not sure with a lot of any libraries or anybody's personal book collections from this period, it's very rare that things survive just because of just, you know, how old things were, and because it was changing from manuscripts to the printed word as well, although there was quite a huge crossover with both of those forms. But we do actually have some surviving material that we know that Anthony himself did own as well. So we know that actually probably one of his favourite authors was Christine de Pizan, which I also find really, really quite good, because she was writing quite a bit before Anthony's time, but she was actually one of the first paid authors for the French court, and obviously being a woman, and actually she wrote quite what we'd probably term as feminist now. I'm not entirely sure how she'd have branded it in those days. Obviously they didn't have that terminology. Yes, but I meant for the time, she really was quite a progressive writer. And actually, Anthony, in his own writings, so he actually does end up translating some of Caxton's first texts that are actually produced in England. In the first one that we know that Caxton definitely had with a date and place of publication, which was actually when he came over to Westminster and started up his printing shop there, was actually Anthony's translation of the Dixon Sayings of Philosophers, which is basically a collection of sayings and moralistic tales created by ancient philosophers like Aristotle, Plato, those kinds of people. And actually, William Caxton himself, in a lot, because he also always wrote prologue and epilogue to whatever text he produced, whether it was a translation by Anthony or whether it was one of his own texts, to kind of give context as to how this text had been produced. And actually, for the Dixon Sayings of the Philosophers, Caxton specifically says that Anthony Woodville had actually removed any misogynistic language out of it. I like to think that's because he was heavily influenced by Christine de Pizan's own writings, which are very much about allowing women to have their own role, pretty much. So I think he had an appreciation, certainly, for women at the very least. So that's kind of come from probably the fact that one of the books that we do know that survives that Anthony did own was actually one of Christine de Pizan's books that he inherited from his mother. So, which we also think, obviously, as she was married to the Regent of France, so that's how she's managed to get a hold of a copy of that. And it does have actually Jaquetta's and Anthony's signature in as well, so we definitely know that was his. And we know that he also inherited some books from his father, so it's obviously a family thing that he's inherited, but it doesn't really come to the fore too much until, like I said, he does become involved with William Caxton. And we know that there's probably two instances that he would have been built this relationship up with William Caxton. So before William Caxton actually became the printer that we know him as, he actually was originally a merchant actually in Burgundy. So much so they actually ended up being the head of the English merchant community in Bruges. So that's partly how we think this connection between William Caxton and Anthony Woodville developed. That it was either through Anthony's role as negotiator and head of Margaret of York's marriage party when she went over to Burgundy, as we know that there was a huge procession into Bruges, and that would have included people from the English community. So it's either through that, or in 1470, you have Edward fleeing into exile when Henry VI is briefly restored to the throne. And with him fled Anthony Woodville, Lord Hastings, Richard Duke of Gloucester, all of the people that were really close to Edward, and obviously Anthony was one of them. And they, whilst they, when they first get to Burgundy, their ships are all scattered, so they all end up landing in different places. They all decide that the one person who welcomed them was actually Louis Grot, Lord of Gruthuse, who was one of the, kind of what you'd say is like a representative of the Duke of Burgundy for that particular bit of Burgundy that he was living in around. His house is actually in Bruges, but he's the one that openly welcomed them, because obviously if Charles, the Duke of Burgundy, had done, it would have been a little bit politically awkward with, you know, welcoming exiles. So actually Louis, Lord of Gruthuse, was the one to welcome them straight away, and they lived in his house for quite a lot of the exile, and he was well known for possibly having the largest library in Europe at this period. We know that that obviously would have been something that surrounded them, and we do know that actually Louis gave books to Edward IV when he came back and started his own library collection. So there's also that transmission of books there as well. And actually that particular book of Christine de Pizan's that I mentioned that had Chiquetta's and Antony's signatures in also has Louis, Lord of Guthusa's signature in. So we think that Antony has passed it on to Louis, possibly as a thank you for saying thank you for looking after us. So it's one of these two points, you know, when he's spending quite a bit of time in Burgundy, that he became friendly with William Caxton, because actually when William Caxton first started as a printer, he actually, his first ever patron was Margaret of York as Duchess of Burgundy. So we know that there is some form of connection there. And actually setting up his print shop in Westminster in London when he does come to England seems to me that he kind of knows already who his audience are. So he must have had some help to get over here in some way. So yes, and I think actually Antony was really unusual because he was not only a patron, he was also the translator as well. After Antony's death, William Caxton was never quite as popular either. He did manage to have other patrons, but nobody as loyal, and certainly nobody was translating his texts for him like Antony did.
Wow, what a fascinating aspect of the story that we don't often hear too much about. And I love hearing about medieval and early modern libraries. They are just amazing. And how fascinating that he had Christine de Pizan's work. I wonder if that is also comes from having all those sisters around him. So he has this sort of appreciation
quite
for
possibly.
Women.
We know that some of the translations he also made for William Caxton were of Christine de Pizan's works as well. So that's partly why it's kind of obvious that she must have been somebody who he thought was a well worthwhile author.
So you mentioned earlier a marriage. Does he have any children?
Yes, so he actually only ever has one illegitimate daughter that we believe he had before any of his marriages. And that is actually the only child that he has. So in the sources, there's one particular Christmas that's mentioned in Reading, which also mentions Elizabeth Scales, Antony's first wife. And there was mention of Lord River's child. So we assume that that might mean possibly his illegitimate daughter, and that might mean that, you know, she was at least welcomed by his first wife. But no, he never had any actual children himself. And Elizabeth Scales, actually, she died herself in 1473 thereabouts, when Antony was actually in pilgrimage in Santiago de Compostela. So he actually wouldn't have even known that his first wife had died until he returned from that journey, which is sad because he took that journey in remembrance of his mother, who had recently died as well. And in the meantime, he's lost his own wife. And they knew each other from childhood, because the Scales family were actually fighting alongside Richard Woodville, so they'd have known of each other. But I kind of feel like, by the sounds of it, the thing that I found one of the most surprising through my research was I was able to find a document to do with the Isle of Wight. So Antony was actually Lord of the Isle of Wight. This particular document is some sort of tax deal to do with the Isle of Wight, wherein you know, we'll give you some tax exemptions if you help say prayers for me and my family. But in it, he actually, this document specifically mentions his consort, which I find very unusual wording, really, because obviously on first glance you think, oh, hang on, does he actually mean, i.e. the queen consort, his sister, Elizabeth Woodville? But actually it definitely says his consort, which you assume probably means Elizabeth Scales instead. And I've not really seen that before. So I kind of feel like, as much as there's not too much known about the relationship, that actually they obviously spend a lot of time together. And that I think they, you know, we can't say specifically that they actually loved one another, because obviously there's no evidence for that. But I think certainly at least that they enjoyed the company of each other at the very least. And actually, after she died, it took Antony 7 years to get married to somebody else. And sadly, that was a 13-year-old when he was in his late 30s, early 40s. But that's not unusual for the time period. But actually, between that, the thing that is also quite interesting is that Edward IV actually uses him as the most eligible bachelor in, other than at this point, George, Duke of Clarence, the middle of the York sons. So he actually very nearly marries the Princess of Scotland, Margaret. And it's actually pretty much all planned out. And they got as far as, yep, you'll get married in Nottingham. And then war with Scotland meant that was actually never happened. So actually, I find that also quite interesting that he's pretty much used as a bargaining tool by Edward IV as well. So I think really must have been quite eligible in that respect.
Yeah, I was going to say, sounds like he's quite a catch. So you talked earlier about his role in his nephew's life, Prince Edward. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about what he did for his nephew and the time they spent together?
Yes, so like I said, actually, Prince Edward was born when Edward IV was in exile. When he was born, obviously, there was no known date of Edward's return or whether he ever could return. So actually, it makes him even more important, really, for cementing the Yorkist regime, because it's already been slightly proved how delicate that is, really. So obviously, when he becomes a little bit older, it's a case of, right, okay, we're going to have to keep him safe, and how do we do that? And actually, he's sent to live in, not in London, as you would kind of maybe expect, but actually he's sent to Ludlow, which is in the Welsh Marches, so in the Welsh borders. And that's basically Edward's ancestral heartland, because he was descended from the Mortimers, who were quite large, important landowners in that area and had owned Ludlow Castle. Really, it's in the middle of nowhere. Even today, it still is. It's quite a sleepy little town these days, and it does kind of feel like the world, modern world, is slightly bypassed it, but all in a good way, actually. Brilliant. I would
Yeah, I
advise
love
anybody to
that
visit
though.
if they could.
I have to say, it's one of my favorite places. So atmospheric. I adore it.
Yes, it definitely is. So I think it's one of the places personally that I find very easy to imagine what it might have been like, you know, when Anthony and his nephew Edward would be roaming around Ludlow Castle, actually, for that very reason. So that's kind of because, as I alluded to earlier, he was in, whilst originally some sort of council is kind of built up to say what should and shouldn't happen for the young prince, whilst that kind of carries on, Anthony's kind of promoted to governor of the Prince of Wales. So he's basically put in charge by Edward IV and obviously Elizabeth Woodville, because she's on this council as well. And, you know, they need to find somebody who's responsible and is going to be able to look after this young prince and help him to grow in a way that would mean he would be able to become the future king and get the education that that would require. Because obviously, Edward IV, when he was a child, he was actually only the son of a duke. So, of course, whilst that's still very high up in the social rankings, it's not, he wasn't destined to be king. So, obviously, that makes an entirely different education altogether, which means he's probably going to have to learn languages, you know, learn about religion, learn about military aspects, have a lot of physical education, as you know, a whole well-rounded sort of, pretty much, even though we personally imagine that the English Renaissance didn't necessarily start until around about Henry VIII's reign, that's kind of the sort of education that at this time is starting to emerge, really, and that it's that kind of education that is needed to make a well-rounded nobleman. And I think actually this is probably the first instance that we can kind of say that that sort of education starts, really. And of course, who better to do that with than somebody who's already proved himself to be a well-rounded person in terms of military, religious aspects. And of course, it really helps when you've got somebody who's the patron of the only printer in England. Well, one of the only printers in England at this point. And we do know that actually the history of Troy that is actually dedicated to Prince of Wales, which seems to suggest that obviously there's a kind of a cycle going on here, that they are reusing Caxton's new texts for educating the Prince of Wales. But actually, Edward IV gives out quite a long list of how this young boy is meant to be educated. You know, he must only have Anthony and somebody else in his care, you know, at all times, other than obviously bedtime, that sort of thing. You know, there's no swearing allowed, no bad language, no profanities, no blasphemy. And really, pretty much everything that Edward IV isn't needs to happen is basically the idea. So, you know, maybe I kind of think that was Edward IV's reasoning there. Choosing somebody the exact opposite of him, and who better than that would be Anthony Woodville. Obviously, not only is there the familial connections there, but you know, he's pretty much ticked the boxes of what seems to be, you know, what should be happening for the young prince. And actually, I think in retrospect, that actually that meant that Anthony probably became the father figure that his own father wasn't with that distance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And of course, unfortunately, as most of our listeners will know, Edward IV dies quite suddenly. So what happens to Anthony after the death of the king?
Yeah, so actually, in this time, any news takes a long time to travel anywhere. So it isn't for quite a while that actually the news reaches Ludlow that sadly Edward IV has died very, as you say, in his early 40s. To be honest, though, I usually say Edward's a lot to blame for things, and I blame him for dying early with his lifestyle.
His lifestyle choices, yes.
basically. So obviously, as within living memory, particularly with Henry the Sixth, and then you have Richard II, who also became king quite young, it doesn't end well. It never ends well because it's an opportunity for people to manipulate a young prince who's obviously not reached majority yet to have their say, and it can also lead to people surrounding them that are grasping and basically not thinking of England, they are thinking of ambition. So obviously there's that fear, but for Anthony, the whole point is, right, okay, I now have to get Edward, the now Edward V, to London to get him ready for you know, all of the coronation and all of that. So Edward actually was proclaimed king at the very least. Obviously, we know he didn't get to coronation, but he was proclaimed. But actually, there's a lot that's been read into the fact that the party didn't leave Ludlow until after St. George's Day. Why didn't they come immediately? When actually, you know, think about it, there's a lot of logistics into moving from Ludlow, where you've been safely cocooned for 10 years of your life, to London. And you've also got to think, you know, right, what have we got to take? How many men have we got to take with us? Because obviously, you need security around you. So there's all that to consider. And I think also the fact that, you know, this is trying to be a religious household, and Antony himself was really quite religious. St. George's Day is a very important patron saint's day. I think it made sense really that they stopped in Ludlow to celebrate that and then moved to London. But the whole thing was that they had agreed along the way that they would meet up with Richard, Duke of Gloucester, along the way. There didn't seem to be any issue with that because, you know, there was agreed, right, okay, we'll take 2,000. 2,000 men seems to be the rough number that people seem to agree on that they would take, you know, with them. Again, there was compromise on there because there was, you know, questions asked of how many men should be involved in this, you know, protection around the new king. So I think there was compromise there, which I don't think even at this point we can yet envision what'll happen before too long, really. That all goes ahead, and they do actually agree to meet at Northampton, because Richard Duke of Gloucester is coming from his lands up in Yorkshire, so they agreed that that would be the best place to meet, so then they could go on the road to London. But actually the whole myth of Stony Stratford now kind of crops up, really. So Stony Stratford is actually a little village / small town out not far outside of Northampton, and that's actually where the majority of the Ludlow party ended up supposedly resting, as they said that actually Northampton, considering it is quite a huge manufacturing town in terms of medieval times anyway, they were saying that there was not enough lodgings to house all of the men who had come, so some of them had moved on to Stony Stratford, which is where, you know, eyebrows start to get raised, really. But actually, I personally agree with what Annette Carson seems to suggest, because even that, whilst it seems a bit weird, it doesn't necessarily seem to raise eyebrows, if that, other than really, because, you know, Northampton's quite a big place. But actually, the Woodville's ancestral home of Grafton Regis is actually not that far either. That's also in Northampton. So Annette Carson seems to suggest that it's possible that they actually took the young king to Grafton, which, again, would actually make sense for protection purposes because it's private. And obviously, the Woodville's home would mean, you know, you're able to protect him more. But also, I can understand why that would be seen as a threat, taking the new king to Woodville ancestral lands, because obviously, at this point, it appears that people are saying, you know, which camp are you going to be in? The Woodville's, or then decide with Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who should hopefully become the protector? Because whilst that is pretty much the line that we think was going to be happening. There was also discussion about whether or not they could have had some sort of council where it's not just one person in charge, it was a council. And I kind of think if that is the route that they'd have gone down, that actually Anthony would have been on that council, because, you know, he's already spent the last 10 years looking after the young prince very successfully and without any issues, no bothering anybody else until, you know, we kind of get to these events, really. But actually, Anthony, and we're not 100% sure whether it was also his nephew Richard Grey, who is one of the two sons of Elizabeth Woodville from her first marriage before Edward, who actually stopped behind in Northampton to meet up with Richard when he got there. So again, no problems. You know, they've agreed to meet personally, and that's still what happened. And they actually met his friends, because I've kind of alluded to before, you know, they but there was no hint of any animosity before at all, really, because even like a month before Edward died, they're actually kind of involved in a legal case together. So they kind of meet on friendly terms. They have dinner, perfectly all right, go to bed, you know, see you tomorrow, that kind of thing. And actually in the morning, Anthony, Richard Grey, and Thomas Vaughan, who was actually the young king's chamberlain and who had been since he was a baby, really, they were all arrested on the charges of a supposed Woodville plot. And I will leave that to your listeners as to whether or not they believe there was one. That's a whole other question. But it's mostly based on the fact that there was supposed Woodville weapons found. But personally, I think from what I've seen, it was probably Elizabeth Woodville. But certainly, definitely Dorset, who was her eldest son, again, from her first marriage, as he seems to be the most ambitious, the most grasping, the most likely to have done it, and didn't really like Richard Duke of Gloucester either. So that's what they were arrested on the charges of, but they're not executed for quite a while afterwards. They're not actually executed until the 25th of June. So, you know, from April until June, that's quite a time span. But actually, they were imprisoned in separate castles owned by Richard at that point. So Anthony was actually held in Sheriff Hutton. And then once we think, again, there's conflicting sources as to whether they actually had a trial or not. And if there was one, who exactly was the person in charge of it? Some say it was most likely to have been Northumberland, because he was, you know, once Richard then moved to London with the king, who is obviously now taken control of and gone to London with, he's the next biggest landowner in charge of the north, so he's possibly the most likely. But other people have suggested it could have also been William Catesby, who was also one of Richard's, some might say, cronies. I suppose that's the easiest word to put it anyway. You know, there's not necessarily enough evidence to say exactly specifically what it was that the, you know, they were meant to have been involved in or not. But personally, I think that Anthony was too far removed from things, that if he did know about it, he was purposefully not told any details. But I think more than likely, he was basically scapegoated for other Woodville actions, really. It's even more sad. But yes, so he was actually executed on the 25th of June, 1483, at Pontefract Castle, along with Richard Grey and Thomas Vaughan. But actually, he wasn't believed to have been wearing a haired shirt, so he actually had a bit of a thing for wearing a haired shirt, which is meant to symbolise clothing like John the Baptist wore, and religious hermits, that sort of thing, because actually that was one of his jousting personas, was a religious hermit, actually. So he was found to have been wearing that underneath his shirt, you know, at execution. And we believe that was actually taken to the priory at Doncaster and was actually held there as a relic until the Reformation. So, which I find also quite interesting, because would you really do that if he was a traitor?
What a tragic end, like so many of the people in this period that we know. This has been such a fascinating discussion, Danielle. Thank you so much. I have one more question for you, though, and that is for a takeaway. I ask all my guests for a takeaway, for something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. So do you have a takeaway for us?
Yes, so I was thinking about this and I was like, I don't necessarily have one for Anthony Woodville, but I have one that is for another Anthony that I like researching, that is probably a bit more Tudor than Anthony Woodville. So Anthony Babington, who was the main person in charge of the Babington plot that got Mary Queen of Scots executed, partly because he actually only lived a few miles away from where I live. So I've always been fascinated by him. So my takeaway is actually on Anthony Babington, and it's a novel also by a local author, and it's called A Traveller in Time. So it's actually a young person's time slipping novel of a girl who goes to stay with her auntie and her uncle when she is ill, and she actually time slips to meet Anthony Babington, and she hopes she can alter his fate. So I thought I would leave that, because that is actually what made me interested in Anthony Babington, not only because he lives a few miles away from me, but actually even now it's a good read. You don't have to be a child / young person to read it. I think it's a good introduction and sort of kind of links the ideas of, hopefully, of the emotional connection that you can get through hoping that you could alter the fate of people who were sadly executed in the end.
Oh, I love that you've mentioned that. That is one of my favorite books of all time. I have a signed copy that's a treasured possession of mine. So I totally agree with you. I love it. I reread it every couple of years because it's so beautiful, so well written, and so atmospheric. Like, I find find those scenes, especially the kitchen scenes, I love. So what a wonderful takeaway. Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the show and chat to us.
It's all right. Thank you for having me.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.